Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Will and I'm here with my two friends, Ant and Anna.
Hi.
Bonjour.
This week we are talking about the year 1393, and I'd like each of us, please, to give our three-word preview of what we're discussing today. Ant.
Busy Bulgarian boys.
Busy Bulgarian boys. Makes sense to me.
That's the
Anna?
Best kind of boy.
They're best kept busy.
The best kept busy in Bulgaria. My three words are, this party's lit.
This party's lit.
Lit.
And that's a modern slang expression.
Yes,
for...
the youths say.
Okay, or is it just well illuminated?
I guess we'll see.
Excellent. And mine is annoyingly accomplished poet.
Is this the day when you read your autobiography?
Yeah. Are you jealous of this other poet?
There's no one on earth I'm more jealous of than another annoyingly accomplished poet. Okay, onwards. Oh, shit, it's me. Right, okay. This week, I'm going to talk about the English poet and author Geoffrey Chaucer.
Oh, I've heard of him.
You have?
Yeah. Yep.
Excellent.
From the movie A Knight's Tale. Starring
should I still go on?
Yeah, I think you should, okay. Please. Yeah.
So Chaucer is a hugely influential figure for the English language and English culture, and he's been called the father of English literature and the father of English poetry. He's called both those things.
Mm. And the uncle of English canoeing.
Very into
little
canoeing.
Known. Yeah.
And as a measure of his influence, almost 2,000 English words are first seen in his manuscripts.
Wow.
And
okay.
In alphabetical order, those words are. So he's a big deal, this guy. And he was also the first writer to be buried in what's now called Poet's Corner, which I think has come up on a previous episode.
It has come up on a previous episode. And using my memory brain to remember what that was, that is in the big churchy place in the middle of London.
That's right.
St. Paul's.
And that came up in
St. Paul's, Westminster Abbey.
The other one. 1245 episode when you talked about the construction of Westminster Abbey.
That's right.
And that's where they stick all the dead poets.
Society.
It's where the society meets,
That's all correct. It's like all history, it's like it's all part of the same wonderful diorama.
Yeah, the same story.
Yeah, it's like just colouring in very slowly a map of the entire human experience.
But interestingly, beyond his writing, he was also famous at the time as a philosopher and astronomer, and composed the scientific work, a treatise on the astrolabe for his 10-year-old son, Lewis. And he was also a career...
I bet Lewis really appreciated that. Dad, I just wanted a football.
He wrote a book about how to do astronomy, basically, for his kid.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but like Agreed. Like, probably the kid didn't read it.
Yeah.
And he was also a career civil servant and a bureaucrat and a royal courtier.
God.
He was a diplomat and a member of parliament. So what I'm going to talk about now is basically all the bits beyond the writing, because okay. I really want to paint a picture of who this guy was, because his life beyond the writing is kind of forgotten, really.
Yeah.
And he was a big figure in lots of ways, and not just for his like confusing, rhyming Old English. So everything I'm going to talk about is really about everything else he did, and to appreciate the real Chaucer, because he had this most extraordinary life. So he was born in London, most likely in the early 1340s, probably in 1343. We're not really sure, but around then. And the Chaucer family is also just like extraordinary as well in its own way, and partly as an example of social mobility more than anything. So his great-grandfather was a tavern keeper. His grandfather was then a wine salesman. So you can kind of see that
he's going up.
His father was then a
tequila.
was a bottle maker.
Yeah, he's going up the stream. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Yes. And his mother was a grape.
All the way back to source. Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right, yeah. And his mother was a grape. So his father, John Chaucer, then was a very important wine merchant,
okay.
and got a royal appointment as part of that role. And so he owes a huge amount to taverns and the booze industry.
Love that.
And yeah. that
the
was
only
really...
real way to get ahead in England at the time.
Yeah, right.
Or currently.
And here's a weird thing that happened in his family history. So in 1324, it turns out his father, John Chaucer, was kidnapped by an aunt in the hope of marrying the boy to her daughter to try and keep the property that they owned as a family in Ipswich. So, but which basically tells you that by the time his father was a child, they're already quite a wealthy family.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
they're all
yeah.
To keep the money.
To marry their cousins.
Marry exactly. their cousins. Exactly. That's okay. the only way to keep your wealth.
Yep.
Agreed. And the aunt was then imprisoned and fined £250, which is about £200,000 now.
Oh, wow. God. That's a lot
yeah.
of money.
Yeah. yeah. So it's a lot of money, and there's just generally a lot going on there in that story.
So that probably in fact, super backfired on her.
Massively. And Chaucer's dad then married a guy called... A guy? No.
Well, that would be an interesting twist.
Yeah, he married someone called Agnes Copton, who inherited a whole bunch of properties, including 24 shops in London from her uncle.
24 shops? What kind of shops? Are we talking like a local Nissa type thing? Are we like corner shop? Or are we talking like some really bougie
yeah,
like
Prada's offies?
On Regent Street kind of stuff, you know?
I think they were all Tesco-y Expressies.
Okay. Yeah. Ye old Tesco-y.
Ye old
Tesco-y. What's the American Expressies? Equivalent of Tesco Express? It's like CVS
yeah.
or Target.
Yeah, CVS, really.
It's great that we have to explain the joke. That really makes it funnier.
Now, everyone should come to England so they can experience Tesco Express on their own.
Other convenience stores are available. And when it comes to Chaucer's life, one of the big differences between him and his other contemporary writers that were around at the time, so there's a guy called William Langland. There's another guy who maybe Andy, you've come across, called Gawain Poet. no?
Okay. Gawain.
Oh, is he the reason the word poet exists?
Gawain
He is not.
Poet.
Oh. He is not.
I am taking Gawain Poet for my rap alias, though, if that's okay with everyone.
But the main difference between him and all these other dudes is that he had this like quite well-to-do family, and then he himself was like a bureaucrat. And
yeah.
so there's lots that we know about his life. There's loads of record keeping about Chaucer. And that's part of why he's become an object of historical fascination, and the other people like slightly less so. And so the first like Chaucer life records actually appeared during his life, when he became a noblewoman's page. A noblewoman was the Countess of Ulster. That he got through his father's connections. And then I'll just go through, I won't go through everything he then did over the following like 20,
Monday,
30 years.
Oats. Brisk walk in the park.
Basically, he's just had loads of adventures.
Yeah.
And I think this is just something that isn't really commonly covered in your English literature syllabus. It's just who this guy was who's writing this thing. So in 1359, during the early stages of the Hundred Years' War, Edward III, who was the king at the time, invaded France, and Chaucer travelled with Lionel of Antwerp, who was the husband of the woman he was the page to. And then as part of that guy's sort of entourage, he was formed part of the English army. And the following year, he was captured at the Siege of Rheims. And King Edward then paid £16 of his ransom back from France. So he got captured, ransomed back.
Wow.
And then from there, he seems to have travelled across France, Spain and Flanders. He went on pilgrimage to the Santiago de Compostela. And then in 1366, he married a lady in waiting to the Queen. So he's very much like in you know, he's not
in
nobility.
Yeah, but he's still in high society. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah.
a hanger-on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like just a generally useful person and trusted person. And although a level down from nobility. So he then studied law and he became a member of the royal court of the king as a valet de chambre.
Valet de chambre, is that the guy that holds the pot for the king?
No, that's the guy that parks the car yeah. in the bedroom.
In the bedroom, right, exactly. Yeah. So it is actually, and I quote, a position which could entail a wide variety of tasks, unquote.
Oof, that is saucy.
Wink, wink. And saucy, chossy.
Saucy, chossy. That's, I damn you for getting to there first.
And his wife also received a pension from the court for employment as well. So she was in the mix as well, being useful as lady in waiting. And he was just traveling all over the place. So he went to Milan for an aristocrat's wedding and then to France again as part of another military expedition. In 1373, he visited Genoa and Florence, where he encountered some of the most prominent Italian poets at the time and had formed close relationships with them and read all about how they were going about their work.
Did they rap battle?
They did. They rap battles. Yeah. Yes, absolutely right. That was in Florence.
Okay, good, good.
That's right, in 1373.
Yeah.
And in 1377, he went on a secret mission to arrange a marriage between the future King Richard II and a French princess to try and end the Hundred Years' War. But they couldn't negotiate the deal properly and the war continued. So he's
really just, he's got his fingers in a lot of pies.
Yeah. Huge number of fingers. And
10 at least.
So I'll give a couple more. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I think you sort of get the impression of this, what this guy is like. It's just the most extraordinary life. And the writing is, you know, which is so influential for English culture, is almost incidental compared with everything else he's doing. So the next year, in 1378, Richard II then sent Chaucer as a secret envoy to Sir John Hawkwood, who was an English mercenary in Milan. And it's been speculated then that Hawkwood was the guy he based the character of the knight in Canterbury Tales. Mm. Not the character of the knight from Canterbury Tales. So anyway, his life just went on like this. He was at the heart of political intrigue and just had adventure after adventure. And I absolutely won't go through everything. But then in 1390, so about 12 years later, he was then robbed and injured on one of these adventures.
Oh, no.
And then seems to have slowed down a bit after that, understandably.
Yeah.
And then in 1393, which is that the year?
That is the year. Because he was born in 1343, right?
That's right.
So he's 50.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a breakneck overview of his 50 years.
I love it. So 1393, he was then granted a pension by the king.
So that's his second pension.
His wife's
double
got a pension.
Dipping.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
So he's getting this official patronage from the king for all his service and literary achievements, and it was quite a generous one. And then he died on. That's the only thing that happened in the 1393, by the way.
What? Then he got a pension.
That's the whole year.
The complete pivot point for this year for 1393 at Chaucer is that he got a pension. Like,
I love it.
Wow. Well,
hey, look, I mentioned a thing that happened.
Yes.
This is true.
By the rules,
scot free.
You have succeeded.
So he then died on the 25th of October, 1400, probably from natural causes, though there's some speculation.
So only 7 years of pension?
He didn't maximise that benefit.
He might have been murdered after because his main patron, King Richard II, had died just before that. And so it's speculated that the successor's gang might have murdered him amongst the various murders.
They were like a loyalist to the former king or something.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting.
Anyway, so there you have it. Just the most incredible life, Geoffrey Chaucer, and the writing was just like the least...
He also did.
Yes, exactly right.
Have you guys read the Canterbury Tales?
I have.
Yeah. Do you have to read it as a child?
We did,
I did not read it.
Yeah.
I have not read it, and I will not read it.
God damn it, I will not read it.
I will die on this hill.
It's very good once you kind of get into the rhythm of the language.
I did used to live in Canterbury, and the tales I have from there are...
not fit for print.
Probably not fit for print. Yeah.
Amazing.
Cool. So, for my turn, busy Bulgarian boys, we're going to talk about the Ottoman Empire.
Ooh.
Now,
been on the periphery.
They've been on the periphery. We've never really focused on them, which is alarming. And I did not know this before researching this, but they were a big, big empire. Like, serious players in the NFL for empires. And they lasted a long time. One of the longest lasting empires, in fact.
Yeah.
And they lasted from about 1299. And when do you think they kind of finished up-ish?
The Ottomans?
Yeah.
like 1920.
Yeah.
1922. Okay, yeah. Boring quiz then.
Hold on, let me say something extravagant. So
yeah,
that can,
yeah, I thought you were going to, okay, yeah. No, fine. Just me that didn't really know that then. They spanned Europe, Asia, Africa, and, you know, 600 years of history. Incredible feat. And it was started by one chap called Osman the First, and he called himself Sultan. And he raided and expanded his territories against the Byzantines, which were the other big players around this time in 1299. It's very, very fuzzy, of course, when we go back that far, so we don't know what's really true and what's not true about Osman. But suffice to say that Ozzy basically just rolled over the people around him, took over Brusa. And that's where his tomb still is. Mm. So Osman, very successful dude. And then by the 1300s, after picking up momentum, early 1300s, they started professionalizing the army. So rather than local militias just banding together for a war and then collapsing back into sort of farming in peacetime again, they came up with this idea and they called them the Janissaries.
Yeah.
And so the Janissaries were a really interesting class of sort of military people whereby they sort of gathered Christians of the conquered peoples and the areas that they took over, and they made this formed military units and this formed army, and they're extremely loyal, and it was the first full-time army in Europe.
So all the Janissaries were Christians?
All the Janissaries, I think, were Christian, from what I can see. And the Ottomans made strategic alliances with the Byzantines as well, but they swiftly stabbed them in the back whenever it was convenient to them. And they expanded like into their areas. And the Byzantine emperor was like, please, please stop for the sake of things. They're like, okay, cool. And then they didn't stop. So by the third Sultan, which is a chap by the name of Bayezid, they basically had rolled over most of modern-day Turkey, but stalled at Constantinople. And they doubled down, just pillaging and raiding and expanding around the areas. And they expanded into the Balkans, took over Macedonia rather swiftly. And then Bulgaria was next on the list.
And then they saw swarms of busy boys.
Swarms of busy boys. And by 1382, they tried to force an annexation. They said, hey, look, just be a vassal state of ours and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll leave you alone.
To Bulgaria.
To Bulgaria. And they said no, and so lots of scrapping ensued. They also went on to Serbia, and it's just a domino effect of just all these places just falling to the Ottomans that were just, you know, this Janissary army just able to just take on anything that came up against.
Except Bulgaria. They were holding out.
Except for Bulgaria at the moment, so parts of Bulgaria. But after expanding so far, the Karaman Emperor in the south were then threatening the borders of the Ottoman Empire. So they had to go back there and back and forth, kind of fighting them and go back to the front lines again in the northwest. There's an instable peace and they went back to Constantinople to siege it. So 1393, the year in question, this saw the siege then and the conquering in Bulgaria of Turnovgrad.
Yeah.
Which is the name of the place.
Yeah.
Let's go with it.
Sounds totally reasonable.
Its modern day name is much easier to pronounce. It's Veliko Tarnovo. So okay. That's fine. 17th of July was when the siege happened. So 3 months. And the Christian patriarch, which we'll talk about a bit, called Euthymius, he led the defense. Euthymius the Pious.
That's nice.
Not actually his name, but
I
think they missed a trick. So he's a great guy. He's such a great guy. They made him a saint. Regarded as one of the most important Bulgarian figures of the Middle Ages, he was a big proponent of something I'd never heard of before called Hayschism.
Excuse me?
Hayschism. Hayschism was a sort of an Orthodox Christian belief of enlightenment through what was called uninterrupted prayer to Jesus. So it's a continual praying.
Huh.
And they did this in a really interesting way.
I think just carry on, but
yeah.
No, uninterrupted prayer. Yeah, except interrupted by the Ottomans, and that's why.
And
he
by
was
the
real.
By the Hayschism at the end.
The Hayschism. But how they
I
did
don't know
this,
what you're saying.
I've never prayed that hard in my life.
Well, I'm going to teach you how to do it. So join along with me.
Oh yeah.
So
what you need to film do it for the Patreon.
Is you bend your head, down.
Okay.
Focus on your chest, and through rhythmic prayer and breathing, they kind of go into this altered psychological state.
Okay.
Where, like, right, they're sort of controlling their breathing and just focusing.
God.
Exactly like that. And then the Hayschism at the end is apparently really intense. So,
wow.
Yeah, go for it. he also set up schools for languages, and he wanted to increase literacy. And it was just center points of culture in Bulgaria. They passed down, I guess, the recipes for borscht and stews and stuff as well. I don't know. Anyway, his uninterrupted prayer was very much interrupted by the Ottomans. But he staged a ferocious defense there for 3 months. So it was really, really hand-to-hand combat, street-to-street, keeping the Ottomans at bay. And he was corralling all the logistics and reinforcements and stuff.
Constantly in rhythmic prayer.
And allegedly, I mean, it's hard to know the passage of time, but allegedly the only reason the city fell was...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Due to treason by one of the non-Christian neighborhoods.
Boo!
Yeah, and so these non-Christian neighborhoods had some key to a gate or supported the troops outside in some way and let them in. Whether that's true or not, it's unknown. There was a contemporary event, it's transcribed. It describes it as follow, that there was a great Muslim invasion happened and total destruction was done with this city and its surroundings. Churches were turned into mosques, priests were expelled and substituted with, quote, teachers of shamelessness, unquote.
I tried to be a teacher of shamelessness, but I didn't pass my qualifications.
Apparently 110 noted citizens of Terranova were killed, but Patriarch Euthymius was reprieved and sent into exile into Macedonia, where he lived out the rest of his life until about 1402, sometime around
there. I mean, quite frankly, that's a pretty good ending for him, right?
Yeah.
He could have got
big time, but he didn't get got unless he got by God when he was canonized.
Oh,
so he got in the best way.
Got by God.
Got by God. Anyway, after the fall of this town in Bulgaria, the rest of Bulgaria did fall about 3 years later and was under the Ottoman rule. But there was still resistant pockets and anti-Ottoman sentiment until about the 17th century, including large-scale uprisings, two of them at least, but to no avail, and they remained inside the fold of the Ottoman Empire until the 19th century.
All right, I am going to talk today about France, or France, as it is pronounced.
Messy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about the curious and somewhat tragic King Charles VI of France. He was king from 1380 until his death in 1422, having come to the throne when he was just 11.
Oh.
King Charles VI was the son of Charles V, who had been a, I don't want to trigger you.
Okay.
Who had been a good king, taking back a lot of English possessions in France.
So he was good from the French perspective.
Yes.
But he was conquering bits of England.
He was.
That lie in modern day France.
Yes.
Right.
yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah. And he left a very healthy budget surplus. But, which we love.
We love finances in this podcast.
We love finances. But because Charles VI is just 11 when his father dies, he's placed under a regency.
And he spent it all on like Pokemon Go cards
yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. He was really into Yu-Gi-Oh. Yeah. Now, the regency is run by his four uncles, who are all, of course, jostling for power in their own right. Mm. And they spectacularly mismanage the country and run down the surplus and just everything is in tatters. Because they're all basically powerful dukes, so they want primacy for their region.
Yeah, they're duking it out.
They're Hey, maybe that's where it comes from. But when Charles the Sixth, I'll stop saying the Sixth, when Charles is 20, he puts an end to the regency.
Sorry, which Charles?
Hold on, let me check. It's the Sixth. He ends the regency. He brings back his father's competent advisors. He restores respect to the throne and people love him. And they call him, very creatively, Charles the Beloved.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
And that's the end of the story. Nope. Unfortunately, it does start to go downhill from there because Charles goes through many, many periods of mental instability. For instance, there was a time when he couldn't remember his name and he didn't know he was king. He didn't recognize his wife, Queen Isabeau, when she came to visit. Once he claimed he was St. George. He would run down the hallways of the palace, howling like a wolf. He refused to bathe or change his clothes for 5 months. Well, sorry, Anne, that's triggering for you. I know.
I mean, it is because I'm on month 6 now and it's totally fine. Yeah, the body has natural oils. Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm in the same room as you. Finally, he thought he was made of glass, and he tried to protect himself from breaking by sewing iron rods into his clothes so that if somebody bumped into him, he wouldn't break.
I mean,
was he made of glass?
He was, yeah. So that one was actually perfectly.
I mean, it's not very funny because this guy was obviously.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
he was like incredibly unwell.
And, poor guy.
I think historians have kind of, retroactively diagnosed him with schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And it's possible that his mother also had it. But he had these periods of total lucidity and then periods of episodes. And since this is the 14th century, there's just not a good way to treat it. But one thing that his court tried to do was surround him with a festive atmosphere and protect him from the rigor of governing as much as possible.
Right, okay. Yeah, so almost sheltering him.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say festive, is it constantly Christmas there? Or is it just like...
It's constantly parties.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm going to, in fact, talk about one party that happened in 1393. His court would just be devising all of these really elaborate schemes to keep him distracted and happy. Like having the women dress in increasingly ornate dresses and hairstyles,
cool.
Which is just objectively hilarious. I think we can all agree. But one of these possible distractions came about in January 1393 when Queen Isabeau threw a masquerade ball to honor the remarriage of one of her ladies-in-waiting. And at this time,
she wasn't waiting any longer.
She was tired of waiting.
I'm so sorry. That's a terrible joke. I apologize. Let's just cut that one out.
I think it's great. I loved it. So at this time, when a widow got remarried, so that her lady in waiting was a widow, and when widows got remarried, people celebrated with, quote, mockery and tomfoolery and all sorts of license, disguises, and disorders.
Right.
So one of Charles's noblemen, a man named...
Here we go.
Huguet de Guise. Nailed it. Who was...
Huguet.
Well, it looks like Huguet.
Huguet.
Huguet de Guise.
You're so American.
Huguet was known for his...
This is going to be so upsetting for our seven French listeners.
I'm sorry. Honestly, though, the French listeners would be more upset if I tried to pronounce it right again. Yeah. Hugh, let's call him, was known for his outrageous schemes, and he suggested that 6 men, including King Charles, dress up as wild men of the woods and perform a dance at the ball. Charles was all in. He loved it. They made costumes of linen and flax, so they seemed really hairy and shaggy. The costumes were sewn to the men's bodies for reasons.
Right, yeah.
And they wore masks. It's possible that they were chained together at the leg. Nothing could go wrong here.
Look, okay, I don't know what's going to happen, but this is a fire hazard.
Well, do you remember what my 3 words were?
Yes.
This party's lit.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah. They wore masks. Not everyone knew the king was one of the dancers. They were dancing in this, like, diabolical frenzy and just, like, cavorting all over the place. They were screaming obscenities at the audience and just being wild men, and everybody loved it. Now, because this was such a fire hazard, someone had very smartly insisted that any lit torches needed to stay against the wall and not come anywhere near the dancers. So they barred people from holding torches. However, Charles's brother, the Duke of Orleans, arrived late and was drunk, and he barged into the hall carrying a torch, which he put down near one of the dancers to see his face and try to guess his identity. A spark fell off the torch and lit the man on fire.
God.
And then, of course, it's just pandemonium. The queen faints. Charles just happened to be standing a little bit removed from the other dancers. And his aunt, who was only 15 years old, throws the long train of her dress over him to protect him from the sparks. And that's what ends up saving him. He doesn't catch fire. Several of the other dancers do. Everyone's screaming, trying to rescue them. One of the dancers jumps in a big vat of wine, and a couple others died. Charles survives. Hugh, the guy whose idea it had been, died of his burns 2 days later. But according to one of the chronicles of the event, he had a reputation for treating lowborn servants like animals. So the nobles rejoiced at his agonizing death.
No.
Wow,
so grim.
I know. So grim. It is just like they. It is so tragic.
Yes.
I mean, already this king had enough to deal with in his life, and what was supposed to be like a fun and harmless thing ends up being this horrific event.
They're so callous as well in their response.
Yes,
just...
I know. It's like...
Also, like, that guy that's renowned for doing mischievous things or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, as far as mischievous things go, dancing around as, like, a fire hazard is not, like, great.
Oh, no, that was...
like, do they, like, rub themselves in, like...
super mischievous.
Like, were they rubbed in candle wax or something? You said flax, right?
Flax and linen, and then I think there must have been, like a resin or something that was keeping the flax to... So they're, like, extremely flammable, and they couldn't get out of the costumes.
Which is the worst thing about
being
a wild man in the woods is how flammable you have to dress.
It's a big fire hazard, and so in the aftermath, most people put the blame on the Duke who had come in with the torch.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there are conspiracy theories that it was an attempt to kill the king.
Yeah.
And that the Duke was a sorcerer, obviously.
I like that one the best.
Yeah. But it came to be known as the Bal des Ardents, or like the Ball of the Flaming Men, but also ardent, the word, like, if you're an ardent admirer of something, that's what it comes from, because you have this, like, burning desire of love for
to
something.
To be a wild man.
Yeah, it's the same, like, not from this ball, but from that, from that French word.
Okay, from that French word. I thought, like, that's where the word ardent comes from.
No, there's no Chaucer's here. Nobody invented any words. But it was basically the beginning of the end for Charles, and the people, instead of being really sympathetic to what had just happened to him, they saw the whole thing as an extravagance and bad judgment on the part of the king, who shouldn't have been organizing.
Cavorting
Which is like, God, add insult to injury, right? They could have been a little sympathetic. But anyway, the attacks of, like, mental unwellness increased throughout the 1390s. But again, his reign lasted until 1422, even though at this point he's mostly just a ceremonial king.
Yeah, he must have been very harmless.
There were,
like, the actual governance of was controlled by...
And there's all sorts of...
The Jafars of the court.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, and the Jasmines, because his queen sort of controlled the regency for the most part. And then, of course, there are all these rumors that she's sleeping with his brother and all this
stuff. Yeah.
And also, what's the bird called?
Iago.
Iago. Iago's the court.
Oh, yeah. Did I not mention Iago? Iago was in the ballroom.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. There's a lot of big history that comes in his reign, like Agincourt is during the reign of Charles VI,
but
he is not really
king.
And then, you know, of course, Joan of Arc comes later, and we'll get to those people at some point. But that's just a little slice of life of Charles VI, who was dealt a pretty bad hand.
Had I told this story, it would have been 98% Agincourt.
Exactly.
Well, Agincourt didn't happen in 1393. Yeah.
No, but I would have jumped off onto his life and then pivoted.
So there's fiery ball and then the war.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I apologize, but I wanted to save Agincourt for you to do.
Actually, I'd have been pretty pissed.
Yeah.
Had you done it. That's really interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's interesting, but super, super grim.
I know, it's grim.
Poor king.
Poor
I never
king
thought I'd be, feel bad for a king.
For the French, yeah.
Or the, for the French, yeah.
It turns out the 14th century, fraught with peril.
Yeah.
Unless you were Geoffrey Chaucer and could just, you know,
do what you
schmooze
wanted
your way into the hearts and
kidnapped,
minds of the
what,
people.
Several times and escaped, yeah. And wrote a bunch of stuff I'll never read. Yeah. I mean,
wrote a bunch of stuff you can't read, in fact.
Look, literacy is overrated.
Just like bathing. Okay, well, thanks for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1393.
And before we go on, I need to once more humiliate myself.
You're so contrite.
And flagellate myself, yeah, in front of the masses.
Yeah, on your knees.
I owe an apology. I owe an apology because 2 weeks ago, in our episode featuring the war... that I talked about
in 1881.
South Africa.
Yeah.
I called it the Boer War.
Okay.
Right.
And it's actually pronounced Boer.
Oh.
So,
right, yes.
Our South African fans have been openly assaulting me on the street.
Yeah, by what they've been hurling things at
they
you.
They have been hurling things at me.
Yeah.
And I am very sorry. I mean, I deserve it. I do deserve it.
Yeah.
And so they don't need to apologize for, but I do. So the Boer War.
Okay.
And I've done that classic thing of just mispronouncing something and not bothering my arse to learn anything.
There we go.
So there you go. But anyway, moving swiftly on, I'll never be wrong again.
You heard it here first, everyone. He'll never be wrong again.
I'm going to stand up.
That's quite a positive outcome, actually, from this, isn't it? That you'll never be wrong again.
Eternal correctness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will be infallible from this day forward until my last.
In the extreme hypothetical that you're not, what happens to you?
Oh, death.
Okay,
just
great.
Just straight up death. Good. Just. Yeah.
Unrelatedly, we'll be looking for a new co-host.
Anyway, shall we go find our new year?
Yes, let's.
Will you please boot up the random number generator?
Absolutely. And as a reminder, we've set the random number generator to choose a year between 1000 BCE and 2000 CE. And the year for next week is 1505.
Oh.
Ooh.
It's like halfway between 1000 and 2000. Actually, never mind. I'll take that back.
Halfway between 1500 and 1510.
Wow, when you think about it like that, that's amazing.
That's crazy. I can't believe we got that.
Yeah. That's going to be good. Loads of stuff happening.
Shakespeare?
Got to be.
Too early.
I mean, he's not alive.
We're getting close. We're really getting close. The Ottomans.
They're still around.
Still in the mix.
They're now a big go-to for us.
They really are. They're catch-all. So we the Romans for the first bit, and then we've got the Ottomans for 600 years.
Well, yeah, it's like the Chinese, and then the Romans, and then the Ottomans.
Oh, yeah, we've got everything covered. This is easy.
History's so easy. History's a laugh.
Great, 1505. We'll see you next week.
Look forward to it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.